loading in 3, 2, 1. Welcome to the Restaurant Coach Podcast. It's the cure for the common restaurant. Expert interviews, tools, and tips to get you the restaurant you know it can be. Now, here is your host, Donald Burns, the Restaurant Coach.
And welcome to the Restaurant Coach Podcast. It is the cure for the common restaurant. You know, I have to say that one of the best things about networking and speaking to people who play the game at high levels is that they challenge you to rethink your mindset and to challenge the way you view your model of the world. Now, my guest today is really going to shake up the way that you look at your restaurant and what is your real purpose. Remember that the truth will set you free, but first it will piss you off. There is so much wisdom in this episode that I think you're going to want to download it and share some of the ideas with your team. Challenge yourself to look at your business differently, and you may find that there are some new answers that can shift your restaurant to new levels. And now, I also have to give credit to Craig for making this interview possible. He's working with a client on the road, and they lost power, so he went next door and called in from the loading dock to make this thing happen. Now, sure, there might be a little more background noise than normal. However, this information is so powerful that you'll want to pay attention, because that's what great leaders do. They take the current situation and they adapt to get results. So with that, let me jump in. All right, and let me introduce today's guest. I am honored to have Craig Shelton on the show today. Now, his resume is quite unique and spectacular. He is the CEO of Shelton Hospitality Group. He's also the CEO of Eon Hospitality Consulting and founder of Kings Row Coffee. He's also an instructor at Princeton University and the winner of the 2000 James Beard Award for Best Chef. Welcome, Craig, to the show. It is such an honor to have you on the show. I know, you know, I follow you a lot on social media. It's an honor to finally get a chance to talk to you and bounce some questions off you.
Don, it's my pleasure and it's my honor. I've been watching you as well and can't tell you how happy I am to be invited on.
Awesome, awesome. So tell the listeners a little bit about yourself. You know, how'd you get started in this industry?
Well, it was accidental, really. I'm a dual citizen of France and America, and I was a very academic kid. I wanted to be a doctor, a surgeon, and I went to a university and studied hard. And then one summer, right before college ended, the senior year, right after I graduated, before going to medical school, I read this article in Gourmet magazine about this spectacular chef who was creating this new thing in America called Nouvelle Cuisine. And it was in Los Angeles, a place called Ma Maison. And the chef's name was Wolfgang Puck. Mm-hmm. And I said, I want to see what that's all about. Maybe I'll take a summer job. And so I knocked on the back door, and you know who greeted me was Gordon Hammersley of Hammersley's.
Wow.
He's a Harvard guy. I'm a Yale guy. So he took pity on me and he let me into the kitchen, and I never got out. And that's the story.
That is amazing. Yeah. Yeah. It's funny what kind of brings you in and what keeps you in, you know?
Indeed.
Yeah. But I always say, I think we always end up where we're supposed to be in life.
I sure hope not.
All right. Well, I want to say, you know, thanks again for taking time to go through the kind of list of questions I kind of called the Dirty Dozen. So let's jump it off with, you know, what is your one word or quote that you aim to live by?
Follow your heart, but take your brain with you.
That's a good one.
As H.L. Mencken had another one. As you know, for every complex problem, there is an answer that is clear, simple, and wrong.
That's a good one. Yeah. I might start writing these down. These are good ones. What is one thing you think restaurants can do today to improve their business?
You develop the habit of deep thinking, which requires one to question their own first assumptions. We're all good at calculating, but we don't really have a habit of deep thinking.
Mm-hmm. That is the truth.
The human animal is, you know, far more important for all human beings, no matter who we are, that we belong to the group rather than pursuit of truth. And this is why institutionals, there's so much institutional failure, you know. Mm-hmm. Groupthink is a big problem.
That is very true. Yeah, and that can be deadly, especially in a restaurant, in an organization.
Yes.
Yep. What new belief, behavior, or habit has most improved your life in the last year?
Well, I was able to start getting back in the gym and lifting weights after a number of years where I had fallen sick with double pneumonia about 5 years back. Wow. Black mold in the lungs, and took a long, almost 6 months to recover. And then, and so that's been an enormous help for me.
Yeah, I think health and self-care is probably one of the most neglected things in our industry is, yeah. You know, taking care of yourself, you know, and we always have the excuse, you know, I don't have time. I'm too busy, but yes. You know, your health is something that you definitely, you sure miss it when you don't have it.
Yes, indeed.
Yep.
So true.
Now, you might have a few of these, so I'm going to start with one, but you can give a couple. What's one book or audiobook that you recommend?
Well, on my consulting website, eonhospitality.com, we mm-hmm. have a tab for the success curriculum, and it lists 16 most important books that we use to elevate technicians into managers, to elevate managers into the C-suite, and to help CEOs improve the performance of their companies. Most important of them all for me is Human Sigma, written by the Gallup organization. Mm-hmm. I would go so far as to call it the most important business book ever written.
Ooh. All right. Now I'm going to definitely have to put that on my list now. And definitely we will have links to Craig's website so you can check out these things. And I'll have links to these books too on the show notes. So don't worry if you're like, oh, what was that you said again? Just go to show notes and you'll be able to find them. So, next question is, who was your biggest influence?
Well, as a chef, I would say it was Joël Robuchon. I was fortunate to work with him at the original Jamin in Paris in the early 80s. And he was the first chef, I believe, in the world to be working on sous vide and, you know, precise temperature cooking. And I had been working on that concurrently in America when I was taking courses at the Yale Medical School. Mm-hmm. As part of my career. So when I found him as the most interesting leader of people I've ever encountered.
Very cool. Yeah, you know, I always find that having, you know, the influences we have, sometimes it's great just to sit back and reflect and, you know, and be appreciative of the people that, you know, taught us, you know, so many little life lessons that we actually still hold on to today in our career.
Yes. You know, Donald, I'm very fortunate because I'm a dual citizen of France and America. Mm-hmm. So I was able to get into a whole host of these incredible kitchens back in the days in the 70s and 80s when you really couldn't without a work visa. It was very hard for America to get in. So I'm, you know, luck is I've come to the, you know, the conclusion of deep study in life that luck plays an enormous role in all of it. And I try to, you know, remember that, sure, everybody works hard today, just about everybody. Mm-hmm. Some of us get lucky breaks more than others. And that's a good thing to keep me humble.
Yeah, very true. Yeah. What do you think is the most common reason restaurants fail?
Well, I've never seen a restaurant fail.
No?
Because the people weren't working hard enough.
Right, that's true.
I've never seen that. But I feel they generally fail because they're not thinking deeply enough. They don't question the false first assumptions of the industry that have been handed down through the generations. And this expresses itself in two primary ways. One, almost all restaurants that fail... Well, let's back up. If you look at recent statistics from Baker Tilly, two important key metrics. One is that EBITDA, which is EBITDA plus rent added on top of it, is only 11.7% for full-service restaurants, barely more than that for the other categories. And since landlords are charging 12% of sales as rent on average or more, that leaves you only less than 2% cash flow.
Right.
The other one, of course, is the sales to investment ratio of 1:1. And that term conflates you know, relaunched assets that fail along with brand new startups, and even that's a one-to-one ratio. So if you can do the math, you'll realize you have to be basically two standard deviations better than the median to have a hope in hell of returning the capital to investors, let alone with a return on capital. That means 98.3% of the restaurants built in the last 20 years are in the process of capital destruction.
Exactly.
The primary reason for that is this fallacy that you can take an urban business model, something that requires 4, 5, 6, 7 seatings a night for its price points, and then transplant it somewhere else geographically that you get far fewer turns, and not have to modify that business model into some hybrid or something else suitable for that location. Instead, they tend to blame their managers for what was a design flaw.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
The second major reason of failure is there are very few managers in our industry. What we tend to do is give technicians titles without any true managerial training, not training in finance, et cetera, et cetera.
Let's go a little deeper into that. What do you kind of classify as a technician?
So, you know, one of the books we recommend is The E-Myth by mm-hmm. Michael Berger. And basically, the reason 99% of startups fail, first time fail, is this entrepreneurial myth. I'm a technician, say I'm a great cook.
Right.
You know, I'm a chef. I run an apartment. I'm a great technician. And because I am a great technician, I am therefore qualified of creating and running a business in which that technical work is done without first learning all these other aspects, right, of management.
Right.
I tell my clients all the time, I said, you know, when I see the signs of disease in the team, generally, managers have this mistaken idea that their primary function is dependent upon the position they have. They believe that the primary function of chef is different than the primary function of an HR manager, then a CFO, and so forth. But I tell them that's completely false, and that's why they don't come together as a team. Right. In my definition, the primary function of a manager is to protect and grow the assets entrusted to the management team while making the owners ever more proud of the business daily. What do you mean by assets? Well, you have cash, you have financial instruments, mm-hmm. you have inventories, you have human capital, you have intellectual capital, reputational capital, real estate, on and on we go. And any one of those subjects could take several years of study to gain competency in. But we have a tendency just to ignore all of these functional needs of business because we're in the so-called restaurant business, which I don't believe we understand very well either. This conflation of the restaurant as one single business, when in point of fact, we manufacture food, but we merely retail beverage, yet we think of them identically and we price them identically, which is why it's such a financial disaster.
Exactly. No, that's so true. Yeah. And again, the E-Myth book is a fantastic book. We'll have links for all this stuff in the show notes. So don't worry if you know, like, oh, what's that book again? So I always tell people this is an adult rated show. So you can say what you feel comfortable with. What's your favorite curse word?
The F-bomb.
I think that's the go-to favorite word for most chefs, I think.
Yeah, if you came up the ranks.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think about this. So, you know, each generation has their own memes. But when I was coming up the ranks in New York City, especially late 70s, early 80s, we all knew every single line from Cool Hand Luke. It was the solidarity, if you will, of like being on a chain gang.
It was. You know, and I know, you know, you, I know you, you know, you met, you know, Wolf and stuff like it. And I was very fortunate to work for Wolfgang for quite a few years, for 5 years. And one of the things, and it wasn't a curse word, but boy, when he walked through the kitchen and he called you a shoemaker, oh, that was deadly. That just like cut you to the core.
Oh, yeah. You know, I was like, I was at Mama's Zone the first week. And I was given this task of the brand new white asparagus had just been flown over from France. Those days, we never seen anything like that.
Yeah.
Here in America. And they let me, you know, cook them. So I peeled them all correctly. Didn't tie them up. Didn't know about that. Remember, I had no training really. Mm-hmm. And put them in a pot of water to boil, tested them with a paring knife, and then turned them, proceeded to dump them into a colander full pell mell like that. And I don't know. They started screaming at me that I'd broken them all, and it's probably at least 25% of them snapped in half. And mm-hmm. I was retired to the potato station for almost a year.
Exactly.
300 different ways to make potatoes. Now they put up with me.
Yep. Yeah, I always tell an interesting story. You know Lee Hefter, right?
Afraid I don't. I don't know him.
Yeah, well, he works, you know, he's like Wolf's right-hand man, but I remember there was a time I made mashed potatoes, and we were doing a menu tasting for Walker Art Museum, a new concept we were putting in up there. And, he goes, make mashed potatoes. And, I've been a chef for years. I'm like, yeah, sure. Great. No problem, chef. So, I go make them, taste them. You overcooked them, do them again. I'm like, well, okay. So do them again. You undercooked them, do them again. I'm like, okay. and this went back and forth like 7 times till I finally got it. And, and it taught me an important lesson about respecting the product.
The ultimate potato puree stories are, of course, with Robuchon, and I won't tell you any of them on the air, but another time.
That's good. We'll have to follow up with you on that one. That sounds really good.
Indeed.
All right. So what's another job or career you thought about getting into? I think you kind of alluded to it earlier.
Yes. I was training at Yale to become a neurosurgeon, and my degree is in molecular biophysics and biochemistry.
Wow. That's fascinating.
And lately, too, I've been thinking about maybe going back for a PhD in economics.
That would be awesome. I think we need more kind of scholars in this industry to help kind of facilitate and get people past that limited mindset they have.
And also I think the field of economics would benefit from people who've had real world experience too.
Exactly. No, it would definitely be a win-win for both sides. What do you say is one of the biggest mistakes you made when you first started out?
Well, I had a simple plan. I thought that if I could ever have my own restaurant and get 4 stars New York Times, we didn't have Michelin then. It's called the equivalent of 3-star Michelin. Everything else would take care of itself. So the idea was, go work for the number one chef in the world. Number one, whatever country you're in, work for the number one chef in that country.
Right.
Work until you get to be the sous chef. So 6-7 3-star Michelin restaurants later running the number one restaurant in America for 4.5 years, the original Boulet, I thought that was the simple plan. So this is what happened. So I'm at the Ryland Inn, right? And we are wicked busy after 6 months of building the business from basically zero. And I don't remember what year it was. We finally got the New York Times 4 stars, the real deal. And I was like, it happened at Boulay and it happened at Le Bernardin before that when I was there, when we got 4 stars. We got telegrams from every restaurant, important restaurant in the world, Jeroboams of champagne from every single champagne house and on and on. And so when that happened at Ryland Inn, I was, expecting we'd get, some of these telegrams and champagne. I've got nothing, not a single one. And worse than that, my business went down. My business volume went down because in the suburbs, the mentality is this is only a special occasion restaurant.
Right.
And I never calculated on that. Obviously, I didn't see that coming. And this was the reason I was forced to learn so many things that if I had stayed in the cities, I would have never needed to learn.
Right.
In order to stay alive.
I still think I have, I still have the gourmet issue with you on the cover.
They went through 3 lenses on that take. Yes.
So what's one thing you're not very good at?
I'm a terrible liar. Everyone can see right through me. My parents just drilled it into me. I didn't use my first swear word till I was 16. That's how tight a ship. You know, my dad's military.
Mm-hmm.
We had a very unusual ultra rigorous childhood. So
I don't think not being good at lying is not a bad trait.
I have to cultivate that personality as a chef, you know, swearing and stuff like that. It didn't come to me naturally, but now it does.
Now it does. years of training, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So tell the listeners what you feel has most contributed to your success.
Reading very, very deeply in a wide array of subjects. I'm unusual because for most of my life, I've not needed to sleep very much.
How much sleep do you normally get?
After I got sick, I needed 4 or 5 hours a night. But for most of my adult life before that, I was able to survive or able to thrive on 1 or 2 hours of sleep a night. So that's why I was able to read almost a book a day.
Wow.
Over 5,000, maybe. I've lost track, maybe 7,000 books, really important ones. And so I'm just cultivating that care, feeding the mind as much as possible, I think is what helps perhaps someone be able to see patterns, connect dots that might not be perceptible otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think reading is probably one of the biggest things to contribute to a lot of my success, and reading a wide variety of things from different topics too.
Most important things I've learned that have helped my businesses over the years were from other industries.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. A lot of the stuff I love to read. I love to read a lot, you know, Western philosophy, Zen, you know, just looking at the world in a different perspective, I think really helps.
As an artist too, you know, the wider your range of experience and the deeper it, the more you'll have to say on the plate.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. You can't be one dimensional. That's the number one thing I think is a killer for people. So what is your best tip for getting the most out of your day?
Well, I believe you should develop yourself and your career on all 5 different levels simultaneously. So we have a kind of we call a mini MBA program strategy. We talk about 5 levels. So the foundational level would be reference materials that are suitable for all business owners, things like the e-myth we've talked about, mm-hmm. finance for the entrepreneur. I think, you know, well, think about this from that. Well, I believe that the function of marketing is to make promises. And if marketing is going to be powerful, those promises have to be extremely valuable to the target niche. They have to be unique to differentiate yourself, and they have to be explicit. And yet in the restaurant industry, I can't think of a single restaurant that actually makes an explicit promise written as like a tagline. Contrast that with FedEx, right? When it absolutely positively has to be there overnight.
Exactly.
That's a promise. Okay. And I think it's vital that you look at it that way. So when we think about the restaurant, and it's the only thing we say, are there at least any implicit promises? And you would say the name itself, Restaurant, mm-hmm. implies the restoration concept, promise. Let's say nutritional restoration and let's say emotional restoration.
Mm-hmm.
And seem to me to be 2 of the conspicuously absent things in culinary school. We really don't give the students a proper grounding in modern day nutrition, understanding metabolism is complex, super complex.
Mm-hmm.
A calorie is not a calorie is not a calorie, and so forth. What does the human being thrive on, and what becomes a toxic diet? Second thing, of course, is the emotion. How do we get pleasure from food? The study, or you know, the senses, the palate, the nose, the sense of smell, the sense of taste, and that is the second thing. I happen to study under Gordon Shepherd at Yale. He's the number one authority in the world on these subjects, and I think it's vitally important that we would teach students about how your sense organs work Mm-hmm. The proof that we don't understand that is every recipe that says season to taste. The massive intellectual fallacy, right? So it's a scientific fallacy. So, you know, we got to start with some foundational. Then there's, you know, self-management. I recommend highly getting things done by David Allen. You know, the classic hallmark of someone who's not yet a manager but has a title is someone who says, I'm too busy. I'm too busy to do this. I'm too busy to do that. It just means they haven't learned time management yet.
Right.
Third level team leadership, like you, this is where I admire your work so much. I use the book very often, Extreme Ownership, by Jocko Willink. It's the eight steel guys who, you know, like you, describe that whole team leadership thing. Above that, and even all these three things are vitally important, they have to occur first. But the real important, the most important of all is this corporate ethos, this human sigma. You know, the book Human Sigma, they come up with this proposition. They pick the largest longitudinal study of ever conducted in business. I think it was a 10-year study, something like 1 million employees, 100,000 managers, 10,000 companies of every sector, public, private, government, not-for-profit, profit, mm-hmm. arts. And they found this was true of every single company in every single industry in every sector. 97% of the managers only hurt the company, causing sales to go down and profits to evaporate. Everything good in the company came from 3% of the managers. And what is the common factor of those 3%? They wrote a book prematurely and they called it, First You Have to Break All the Rules.
Exactly.
So it seems to indicate that our business schools and whatever are doing a fantastic job with almost perfect success in teaching, but the content is almost entirely wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And finally, after you know you've got that, then I believe it's imperative to have a macro picture, you know, macro strategy in which you're trying to figure out this change is ever more frequent and ever more volatile. You know, there was a time when you could several generations ago, just put your head down, just work harder, and it probably would work out. Don't think too deep. I mean, the thing that I find the most offensive that I hear in the restaurant industry is it's not rocket science. I couldn't disagree with that statement more than possibly anything on the planet. I mean, to me, rocket science is largely spherical geometry. You can master that at the age of 14. Getting a restaurant to run well is you know, it's like ocean sailing. It's 100 different disciplines combined in one.
Yes. Very true. So true. So true. So I have a couple of bonus questions for you. So what was it like winning a James Beard Award?
Well, it really knocked me for a loop because I never, ever thought, you know, remember that cover of the New Yorker magazine, which was the map of America from the perspective of Manhattanites, in which Manhattan is almost the entire purpose area of America. And it's like a parallax view in which it diminishes to like California as a blip, you know, and the middle of America doesn't even exist and so forth. And so I just never expected that our location would permit being even considered for it. And I think I was nominated 7 or 8 times.
Mm-hmm.
Took a long time. It was a great feeling to be recognized and you know, for the hard work of the team and, mm-hmm. and all of that. Yeah.
You know, that's one thing. I talked to quite a few people that have won James Beard Awards, and they're always very humble about that. It's definitely a team effort, you know. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Very, very humbled, which is always a great thing to understand. And, you know, one of the things I always find is, you know, being in industry so long, the higher up the level of development, you know, personal achievement and development and just self-awareness, the more humble the person are. Like when I first started contacting you, you know, I think I emailed you, hey, chef. And you're like, you know, hey, call me Craig, you know.
Of course. Yeah. You know, the two Yale scientists, just pure coincidence, but they describe this. It's called the Dunning-Kruger effect. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's you see it every day in restaurants. And you know, the teams that are the least trained are the ones who least want training. And the ones that are the most trained are the ones that have the greatest appetite to learn more.
Yes. Hunger is a huge thing. Yeah, it is a huge paradox, but it's also, it's the equation that a lot of people overlook.
Well, none of us know what we don't know.
Exactly.
And so I think it's a constant process. Each, and I don't read, you know, schlock. I read the most important books I can get my hands on. And I never read one book at a time. It's always 30 books open and simultaneous, you know, because they all interrelate after a certain point. Mm-hmm. I think it was a professor of mine who said, Craig, if you take any subject deep enough, it converges with every other subject. And that's generally where my reading gets me into these next web of nodes, right? So we start to see these patterns develop.
That is true. Everything is interconnected. I do notice that too when I read a lot, is that, you know, yeah, wow, that theme, oh, that could translate to this book, and that, oh, that could translate to this. Yeah.
Wow. So
the other day you commented on, you know, I had a post up about prime cost, and you used the words enlightened cost management. Could you dive into that a little bit?
Surely would. So first of all, what I don't want to leave anyone with the impression is that I'm in any way sanctioning not learning what prime cost is and becoming competent in how to calculate it. Okay. So like any subject, you know, you're going to have different levels of competency. And if there's one thing that is sorely lacking in our industry, it's financial literacy, right? The two key concepts in finance, right? Two foundational concepts, the time value of money and the pricing of risk. And if you don't understand that, it'd be hard for you to answer the question if we went to a bodega and tried to buy a lottery ticket and asked for $10 of Mega Millions, and the cashier were to ask us, would we like the prize as a cash payout all at once or the annuity? Why is the total amount, the nominal amount of the annuity payment so much more than the cash? I've asked this to almost 12,000 restaurant professionals, and only three have gotten it right. They all tell me, Craig, it's the taxes, right? I said, absolutely not. It's time of money. Now, you know, it's important to understand this. Without having these financial precepts down, you're very likely to make nothing but wrong decisions in management.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about prime cost, because to me, that is one of the most dangerous concepts that has ever come down the pipe from the accounting squads. How do I get there? And how much time do we have? Because this will probably take 5 minutes.
No, take your time. Yeah.
Okay, great. So to unpack all the errors that are inside that, we need to start with this idea of how our industry prices food and beverage. And for time immemorial, what we've done is we simply had a rule of thumb where we take the cost of the materials on the plate, what we call the plate cost, mm-hmm. or we take that bottle of wine and our wholesale cost, and then we multiply it times some coefficient. Mm-hmm. The classic in France and was always times three.
Right.
So for the sake of simplicity, I'll show you a three-item menu. Here's a chicken dish, $5 cost. Here's a steak, $10 cost. Here is a rack of lamb, $15 cost. The retail price on the menu would therefore be chicken 5 times 3, 15, steak 3 times 10, 30, rack of lamb 3 times 15, or 45. This is our retail prices.
Right.
Now, if we subtract the cost of goods from the menu price, the retail price, that gives us gross margin, $10, $20, and $30 respectively.
Right.
Our accountants have taught us in the GAAP system that we will attribute hypothetically 50% of that to labor, $5, $10, and $15. Now that could vary from restaurant to restaurant, from sector to sector, but these are the principles I'm talking about. about approximately 50% for labor and 40% of that gross margin typically to what we call overhead, which is a catch-all term for every single other bill that we have besides those first three. And so that would leave us with a net operating income of theoretical net operating income, $1, $2, and $3. Okay. And the question is that even real or is that a gross error? So I say, for example, if we had a restaurant with 100 chairs and on one night 100 people walked in, all sat down at once, all had their chicken dish. On another night, 100 people walked in, all sat down and had the steak dish. Another night, 100 people walked in, all had the rack of lamb dish. Mm-hmm. Would the labor cost vary by even a penny, theoretically? No. Would the overhead vary? No. So we need to think about both labor and overhead as fixed costs. That's the first thing.
Right.
The second problem with all of this is thinking of your business as a single business. Okay. So if you were a brand new client of mine, you'd come to me because like 98.3% of restaurants are in financial trouble. Or if you're the 1.7% that's cash flow positive sufficient to pay back your investors, you just might want to do a little better. So I'd ask you, what are your key performance metrics? What's your labor cost? What's your food cost? What's your beverage cost? What's your overhead? And you might say to me, Craig, my labor cost is 35% net, but there's another 10% for taxes and benefits. Mm-hmm. Okay. My food cost is 35%. My beverage is 25% and my overhead is 25%. I'd say, Don, considering the quality of food you're doing, center of plate protein, real food, not just flavored starch, you're doing a damn good job at 35%. Labor with the quality you're doing, you're a three-star type restaurant. My God, that's beautiful, wonderful. Your overhead, you know, with today's rents, rates, all that magnificent. Now, here's what we've learned from over 100 years of financial analytics. It's extraordinarily rare when a restaurant can pay back its invested capital with a return on capital. That is, in other words, to have a positive return on investment, unless the sales mix is roughly 50-50,
right,
between food and beverage. Now, why is that? So let's use, for easy math, let's pretend your restaurant does $10 million a year in total sales, five in food, five in alcoholic beverage. What we're really saying then is that your labor cost is $4.5 million or 45% of the $10 million. Your overhead is $22.5 million, 25%. Your food cost is $1.675 million, that's 35% of $5 million. And your beverage cost is $1.25 million, 25% of the $5 million. Okay, so here's the scenario. It's a Saturday night. It's 4 o'clock. You have all three of your bartenders scheduled to come in because this is your busiest night by far. Okay? And because their restaurant employee is not making much money, they decide to carpool. And they get into a horrible car accident. Two of them are rushed off to the hospital. The one remaining bartender, she comes in like a hero. The only thing you can do is give her a couple busboys to help, and she tries and does a remarkable job, but she cannot card everyone like three people can. And this just happens to be the night that the Alcohol Bureau is there conducting a sting, and as a punishment for you, because you're successful and highly visible, they take your liquor license away for 2 years. So the first question, Don, is how much of that labor, that $4.5 million of labor, can you shave and still produce the $5 million in food? And the answer is, not only can you not shave a penny, you're going to have to provide wage augmentation for your front of the house employees, or they're going to defect because their income just went down by about 50%.
Exactly.
What about your overhead? What can you shave in that overhead? Not a penny. So the reality is, we're thinking about it all along. We do not have a business called the restaurants. We have two businesses. We manufacture food, we don't have a 45% labor cost. We have a 90% labor cost in the manufacturing of food, a 0% labor cost in the retailing beverage. It's purely incremental. We don't have a 25% overhead. We have a 50% overhead in the manufacturing of food, zero in the retailing of beverage. When you add the cost of goods, you realize that the average restaurant is losing 75% in the manufacturing of food, and they may try to make up for it by marking up beverages times four so they can have a 75% cash flow on that side of the business. And so what you can see, that's the first problem. That's the first problem, is that we lose so much money on food.
Right.
One of the reasons is I just went through, it's this mathematical illiteracy in which we price food as if we were only retailing it rather than manufacturing. Let's go back to that for a moment. So as you, as we pointed out earlier, the labor doesn't change and the overhead doesn't change depending on what the customer orders. Therefore, the true case is probably the middle case of $10 of labor and $8 of overhead is the true cost regardless of what the customer orders. Now, if we add the cost of goods onto it, the chicken is costing us $23 in reality. Not what our accountant told us. The reality is that we're losing $8 on a chicken we're priced at only 15. That's a 55% loss.
Right.
The steak we're making $2 on, and we're gouging the lamb customer $12 of profit on that dish. Of course, all of these types of errors create an unintended consequence of punishing the good customer and rewarding, or turning some customers into bad customers and rewarding them.
Right.
So there's a massive defection from, you know, from the lamb customer mm-hmm. and the steak customers even over to the great value, right? It's priced way below our cost. It doesn't take too many more errors like that before it's comprehensible why you're losing so much money in food, just because you can't do third grade math. So then we get to this problem, okay? That's just the beginning. That's one sector of the problem. The next mm-hmm. thing is this, Don. Have you ever noticed traveling the world, all the other nations except for America that have had restaurants in existence for over 100 years, when you travel there, Italy, when you travel there, France, Germany, Greece, whatever, mm-hmm. you're going to find in every other country that the vast majority of the recognized restaurants are not in the cities, but sprinkled throughout the suburbs and the countryside. The great, whereas in America, only our good restaurants are recognized, are only found in our international cities, nearly without exception. What exceptions exist are usually part of a resort as an amenity. Now, why is that? I've asked this question also to over 12,000 people, including some fancy MBAs. No one has ever really put it together. It's very simple. All those other nations, when restaurants were coming, they still were in a political structure of elitism, of, let's say, a constitutional monarchy or an outright empire. Mm-hmm. And so the clients for full-service restaurants were these ultra-elites who would never put up with the idea of turning tables, having to give up a table, or a table not being reserved and waiting for them, even if they're 2 hours late. So the rest of the world has food in restaurants. The pricing of restaurants is based on a single seating. And since, you know, what the labor and the overhead is essentially fixed,
right,
with a single seating concept, you have to charge exactly twice the price of a restaurant like in Manhattan, that a three-star Michelin restaurant does four seatings. You can actually cut the price in half of what you'd have to charge in a countryside the same food, same equivalent experience. A bistro in Paris might do two seatings, but a bistro in New York might do eight.
Exactly.
Not taking that into consideration. So what happens is axes by which I talk about this. So I made a template spreadsheet. So one axis, I call it the horizontal, represents where you're located. There is a geographic penalty in America because of the location. So like if you're in Manhattan, you'll do four seatings at a Michelin restaurant. Second tier city, three seatings. Right on the edge of urban, suburban, maybe two seatings. And once you're in the suburbs, exurbs, it's a single seating. Okay. And then the other axis, the vertical axis, I call it the sales mix, beverage sales as a percentage of total. Mm-hmm. So if you have starting like a 50% sales mix and you're in Manhattan, that predicts a prime cost of 62%. Move that restaurant to the second tier city, your prime cost suddenly automatically rises to 73%. Move to the urban, suburban border, and you're at 95% prime cost. Move to the suburbs, you have 160% prime cost theoretical. If you have your beverage sales drop from 50 to 40 to 30 to at 20%, if you're only doing 20% sales of liquor, 80% food, and you're in the suburbs, you should be having a prime cost of 227% with perfect management. There's no, the problem is not bad management. The problem is bad design. So how does this come and how do I express this? Okay. So for example, if you've taken a restaurant and you've imitated a restaurant that you love, like La Bernardini, and you tried to replicate it in a suburb, and then you came along and you said, look, my labor cost is too high. That's quite likely a false calculation. It is your business model is flawed, right?
Right.
Just because, and so forth. I'll give this in some practical explanations. 99% of the time when I'm with a client and they say, Craig, my kitchen labor cost is too high, I turn to them and say, and who is responsible for that? And they say, the chef, of course. And I said, absolutely not. It's your front of the house director who's responsible for that. What do you mean? Your sales mix is 80% food and 20% beverage. If your front of the house was selling beverage sufficiently so that you were at 40 or 50% beverage and, you know, 50 or 60% food, the kitchen would be running below budget. Okay. So the quip I make is that there are 100 ways to achieve a prime cost target number. Let's say you want your prime cost to be, 68%. I can think of 100 different strategies that you could use to obtain that number. But 98 of 100 are going to kill your business.
Exactly.
Because they will attack. Most people only know how to basically exploit their employees even more or exploit their customers more. Take more off the plate. Substitute more toxic ingredients or, you know, don't pay your employees a better wage or don't even pay them their overtime or, you know, all the things you and I have seen in the industry. Instead of saying it's your job to get to work and think about how to improve your business model. Think about this. The average restaurant in America has only about less than a 2% cash flow. But the average banquet facility, wedding facility in America has like 25%.
Right.
You know, are they smarter? Are they better? Are they like supermen in intellectual giants? No, they've got a good business model. We got a shitty business model that has not been updated for 150 years since it first came over from Europe. And it was a false business model the day it came over. And that pricing formula of just multiplying times three worked in the old country. It worked in the old country because if you owned a restaurant, 99% of the time it's because your dad left it to you. You inherited it with no taxes. Yeah. Your father inherited it from his father and so forth. So you didn't have to include capitalization costs in your pricing formula. And guess who your labor was? Your labor was your family. You didn't need to really calculate. So this type of a shortcut of just taking the cost of goods and pricing that out. So think of the contrast. We go back to that little menu of three items. Supposing we said we're actually going to commit the ultimate heresy in our industry, which is thinking. And we're going to price food based on the fact that we manufacture it. So we're going to include the overhead of labor labor and overhead. So all of a sudden we're going to say, okay, we're going to take the $18 of labor and overhead plus, and say just a random $2 of profit. We want to make $2 on every one of our customers. And then the cost of goods on top of that. So the chicken becomes not from 15 rises to 25, which is where it should be. The steak stays alone and suddenly, and the rack of lamb plummets from 45 to 35. Okay. Now, we're not making much money at all on any customer, just $2. But the most important thing is we're no longer losing massive amounts on most of our customers.
Exactly.
All of a sudden, that need to have a 4x markup on a bottle of wine vanishes.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember this, when I came into New Jersey in the early 90s, one of the great wine importers here, the Lauber father and son, came to a restaurant I was at, and they said, we love you. And I said, why do you love us? And he said, because, you know, we got into the business of wine importation because we love the great ones, the first growths, the Bordeaux, the Grand Crus. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at that time, he said, 97% of these great wines that we import, we sell through restaurants, and only 3% through liquor stores, because they simply don't have the knowledge base to work with. Oh, that's interesting. Well, then comes along the transparency movement. We have now suddenly people like Robert Parker commoditizing wines with point scores.
Mm-hmm.
You have the information age. Customers are suddenly figuring out that restaurants are gouging them on the wine. Now, that's only half the story. You know, and they're never paying attention to the fact that restaurants are losing their shirts on food, but that maybe that isn't made. At any rate, the point is that by the time the year 2004 comes along, if I remember correctly, the ratio had completely reversed. By that time of total transparency, 97% of the fine wine imported in New Jersey sold in liquor stores, and only 3%.
Wow.
In other words, the restaurant industry would rather see vanish the entirety of the good part of its business, the retailing of wines by the bottle,
mm-hmm.
rather than have to sit down for 10 minutes and consider some mathematics about their pricing formula. So, prime cost is most often... It is vital to understand what it is, but it's also vital to understand how it can be a tyrannical beast
right.
that stands in the way of all good thinking. If you are not in Manhattan, in a great location in Manhattan, or Chicago, right in the sweet spot,
mm-hmm.
if you're not in the highest density, highest number of turn areas in America, you need an alternative strategy that recognizes that reality. You may need to add to your restaurant business. You may need to shrink your a la carte and grow some other type of, well, consider this, Donald. If you and I owned a hotel in Manhattan, the most we can sell a single guest room is once a day, correct?
Correct.
But that's also true in the suburbs or the countryside. You can only sell a guest room once a day. If we had a banquet company, if we had a single ballroom that holds 150 people, and it was in Manhattan, we could only do a single wedding of 150 people in that ballroom. It's mm-hmm. the same is true in the suburbs and the country. But here's the big kicker. What is the price of an acre of land in Manhattan? It could be $1 billion. It could be $2 billion. It could be $5 billion, depending what it is. What's the price of an acre of commercial land in the countryside? It might be 10 grand. So that even though you don't get as high a room rate, the return on capital in those two sectors might be better in the suburbs and in the countryside than it is in the city.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so design your business to those realities. And that's the way I would attack. Of course, there are hundreds of different strategies, but right. what's common in all of them is that it's contrarian thinking.
Yes.
I'm not a contrarian by heart. The world has forced me to be one.
That's true. It goes all the way back to that, you know, you cannot solve a problem at the level it was created.
That's right.
You know, and I think we need as restaurant in the restaurant industry today, especially with, you know, the way the economy is and the way the different, the geographical and political, you know, climate is shifting about minimum wage and things like that. We need to relook and rethink our business models.
Yeah, listen, the restaurant business model was unsustainable
yes.
100 years ago. And, you know, it's been kept alive on life support
yes.
with a porous border, with wage suppression, wage theft, automation, consolidation. Well, we have to understand at the macro level, we're living in an economy in which the public policy levers have been set to maximize artificial asset price inflation. That means land is going to rise in price 10 times, 100 times, even 1,000 times faster than household income, or how fast you can raise your prices as a restaurant, depending on locations. And therefore, the minute you have a successful business model, it's already obsolete, because you're never going to be able to keep up with the increase in occupancy cost.
Exactly.
And the only rational response to that from the business sector is consolidation, fewer and fewer companies that are larger and larger, and number two, virtualization, right? So why do so many people walk around with their heads in screens? Because it's a more hospitable universe in there. Sadly so.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, connection in the internet and smartphones are supposed to bring us closer together, but I think they've actually taken us farther apart.
Yes. Well, listen, you know, when I was a boy, my father, who was just who had a working class job, blue collar job, saved 10% of his gross for 3 years, and that was sufficient to put a 20% down payment on 80 acres of nearly oceanfront land in New Hampshire and build a house, all for $23,000. For my son to do that today, he'd probably need to be making $6 or $7 million a year.
Yeah, exactly.
Huh? Right out of college.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have to understand that most of the problems, like, I think one of the most dangerous fallacies, and it's important, like, you know, when we talk about the great training that you got as an elite member of the military team, like the Navy SEALs, they stress total personal accountability. That's a good story as far as it's true. It's not the complete truth, but it's an important first level of truth. But the reality is that 90% of the people in the world, where, you know, we have this mythos in America that everyone ends up wherever they do because of their own personal choices. And that is so offensive as to be possibly the most satanic thing I've ever heard. The reality is that 90% of the human beings in the world, and the American included, end up wherever they end up, mostly because of other people's decisions. 6 million Jews didn't end up massacred by the Nazis because of some failure of theirs, some thinking failure of theirs, Maoist pogroms and all that. And, you know, 25 million people didn't lose their jobs, their houses, their businesses in the credit crisis because of their failures. It was the failure of a tiny few people who set public policy, who employ British banking regulations rather than German guidance of credit, for example. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the whole idea of just keeping your head down, okay, and just trusting the process is horrible advice. Yes, in the beginning of your career, in the middle age, there's a time for everything, but you have to eventually wake up and realize that that an awareness why is all the farmland vanishing, right?
Right.
Yeah, well, these are things that are consequences of public policy decisions, and they affect us all. We dig down, and this is probably why I'm a chef. When I was a boy, we'd spend a lot of time with our family in France, in London, France, Paris, you know, and what amazed me when I'm in France, I would eat without consideration, without questioning the calorie, including dessert. And I would lose weight and feel fantastic and vibrant and you know, clarity of mind like never before. Come back to America and eat industrial food because, you know, we didn't have a lot of money.
Right.
And suddenly gain weight and feel sluggish. And then the problem is I'm taking all this science course and physics and chemistry professors are telling me a calorie is a calorie is a calorie. But my own real world experience is telling me that's false. And somehow or other, I knew that there was something that the French had to teach the Americans. And I remember this when I told Herb Wishengrad, who's the investor at Boulay, I said, you know, it's 4.5 years, I'm ready to leave. And he says, Craig, I'll back you on anything you want to do. Mm-hmm. I said, well, I want to leave the city. And he said, why in the world would you want to leave the city? You know, and I said, well, the first reason is phantom equity. And he started chuckling. And I said, the second is this, you know, we are kind of fooling ourselves. You know, our food on the plate visually looks identical to 3-star Michelin food in Europe, but the content is different for two mm-hmm. reasons. The reason that the French cuisine at the time, and perhaps you know, largely to this day, considered the greatest cuisine on earth, was not because of the sauces or the science, although those were wonderful aspects of it. But the reason that French cuisine is the supreme cuisine on earth at the time and possibly still to this day is because French agriculture was mm-hmm. the most nutrient dense and cleanest, most organic. And that came about almost accidentally because the decision tree was always about most flavor, most pleasure, right? And so think about this. In America, they've been telling us this for the last almost 50 years after the McGovern Commission listened to that crackpot Ansel Keys. That dietary fat causes heart disease, right? One of the most destructive, probably caused more death, illness, and economic damage than all the wars America has fought put together. And so think about the preposterousness of this. So basically the nutrition scientists that came out of this government established decision were basically saying, if it tastes good, it's bad for you. But if it tastes bad, it's good for you.
Right.
And, you know, and I'm thinking to myself, like, and did you guys even study Darwin? Because how on earth would we have developed negative feedback loops for the extinction of the species, right? Just mind-boggling sometimes how we can get ourselves tangled up so badly.
Yeah, we have misguided and broken thinking patterns.
So, you know, again, this speaks to the idea that maybe taste is not so subjective after all. You know, that we have taste buds for a reason, right?
Right.
You know this, Donald, in every restaurant in the world at a certain hour of the night, plates start coming back into the kitchen because they begin to be mis-seasoned, right?
Right.
And this is because the chefs have never had scientific training to understand how to understand their own palates or anyone else's, right? Mm-hmm. We understand today, of course, that, you know, you can, let's use simple language, not scientific language. You develop a tolerance with successive tastings of salt. You need ever more to be able to perceive it. So telling someone, your cooks, to season to taste is a guaranteed way to not do it right, right? It's going to be plates. Mm-hmm. What I developed at the Rylan was a different thing. I said, why do we use salt in the first place, right? So I'd say, take a raw potato, guys, peel it and slice it on a mandolin paper thin, okay? And then put it on your tongue and leave it there. Of course, what happens? Over time, it begins to digest from the enzymes that are contained in saliva. Mm-hmm. What is starchy and blah tasting suddenly becomes sweeter and sweeter and sweeter. And I said, you have to understand that digestion begins in the mouth, and salt is the key trigger. Salt will trigger the saliva gland. So what I told people, the way to season food is not to worry so much about the flavor. First of all, your own sense organs will trick you every time.
Yes.
Your sense organs never measure anything on a scale of absolute, but only a scale of relativity to what just happened before.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, and secondly, then there's this whole thing of nature versus nurture. You know, in Johnny's family, they poured the salt on, and you said when. In Sally's family, mom didn't use any salt. So you have these cultural issues as well. How are those two people going to put out a product that is consistent when they have such a dissimilar background of what is subjectively determined taste. So what I want to do instead is, it looks the same, but put the, you know, taste the food, you know, and wait for the rush of saliva. If it doesn't happen, add a little more, add a little more, add a little more until it does, and then immediately stop, even if you can't taste it.
Right.
So, you know, even at Boulay, we would have 30, sometimes, you know, 20, 30 plates a night come back when the cook's palates were fatigued.
Oh, wow.
But at Ryland, sometimes we had, at one year, we had only a single plate come back in an entire year for seasoning issues.
That's amazing.
A different type of strategy. Yeah. Like, it's scientifically based. That's, you know, think about the fact that for over 125 years, all scientists knew that searing a piece of meat does not lock in the juices, does exactly the opposite. And, you know, we're here, we're still hearing that even today.
Yeah.
So those, you know, those are kind of the things that we talk about when we get into the kitchens, technical things, you know. And one of the things you'll notice on the website or in that book, the 16 block, is a really important book called The Goal. No other book, I think, is more important for manufacturing. And if you don't understand that your kitchen is a manufacturing plant, right? To put it this way. What kitchen have you ever heard of? What restaurant you ever heard of in your entire life where the kitchen doesn't get into the shits, right? Usually it starts at the garde manger, then it moves to the grill, then it moves to the sauté, then it moves to the, who knows, you know, maybe it moves now out to the floor.
Right.
And restaurateurs and managers think that this is a good thing, that they pare the labor down so tight that you never see anybody, quote, just standing around, unquote. But that's absolute proof that they don't understand their business.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're a, you know, well, think about it. A restaurant is a mal-designed business in the first place.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
So if you were going to establish just a manufacturing plant, you're going to make, you know, eyeglasses, right? You would want to locate that at the cheapest possible location, right? $2 a square foot that has access to major highways. On the other hand, if you were if you wanted to retail these very expensive elite glasses and perhaps Swiss wristwatches,
right,
you'd want to be in the most expensive real estate on earth, right? In Madison, mm-hmm, or whatever, Rodeo Drive. So this is the problem of a restaurant. It's a malinvestment no matter what. Right? If you put the restaurant on Madison Avenue, all the square footage that's devoted to manufacturing is an economic waste.
Right.
But if you put the retail where the manufacturing plant should be, you don't get the traffic, right? So this is another reason you're going to see an ever shrinking amount of, you know, the way, you know, we grew up cooking, big kitchens with, you could, you know, they were teaching kitchens. You could learn, you know, thousands of different dishes. That's not going to survive in a, you know, very, very often in a world in which real estate continues to rise on an R square curve.
Yep.
You know, so those are, you know, some of the insights that we look at. The Goal was this book that, you know, they were seeing that all the manufacturing plants had been turned over to management from people coming out of business schools, the Whartons, mm-hmm, the Harvards, and so forth, and things were going disastrously. This just-in-time kind of concepts, basically what we call cost basis accounting management. It's what we use in the restaurants to this day. You basically have these sales, whatever they are, you know, and that's the soft skills, and nobody likes to learn about that because we're tough men, right? And then you've got, so you got this income, and now you got all these hundreds of line item expenses. And if you can shave any one of them, it magically drops to the bottom line, all these savings, except it never worked. It never worked. Okay. So this is another important aspect. What they found was that, you know, like the book Human Sigma, the greatest crisis that happens in business,
mm-hmm,
trying to manage people as if they were objects.
Oh, exactly.
And the manager, and this is to some degree true in the, so you think about like a restaurant, okay? If you're in the suburbs, you may only have one seating a night. And that's because, what if you could get two? What if by only adding another two or three people in your kitchen, you raise the throughput rate? What if, like, every chef basically thinks his purpose is to create maximum complexity on the menu?
So,
The average menu, I got a double cut veal chop, okay, and I got a veal scallopini. One dish takes 45 minutes to cook correctly with gentle heat. The other one takes 45 seconds.
Right.
So he's the most talented guy in the kitchen, and he believes it's to show his prowess and his skill. He wants to have the maximum different types of techniques, the maximum different types of products. And ordering a scallopini, ordering a double veal chop, ordering an omelet, ordering a hamburger, ordering a steak, and you guys figure the fucking thing out.
Exactly.
You know, and one dish takes 40 minutes, one takes 40 seconds, and the cooks are supposed to bring them all up at the same time. When in point of fact, what a great chef should be doing is reverse engineering every single dish so that it takes exactly the same hypothetical, say, 4 minutes of execution, so the cooks don't have to worry about timing.
Right.
And you can do that oftentimes improving the quality, right? One of the biggest fallacy in cooking is the idea that high heat is good for protein. It's only good for the Maillard reactions in the exterior. But for cooking the interior, there's nothing you could do worse for the end product than using high heat. So if you can take protein out of the equation of complexity by having it in stasis, in sous vide or in holding, rational ovens or whatever, suddenly so in other words, the total goal for a manufacturing plant is to increase throughput. Okay. So if you can do two complete seatings in what used to take you the time to do only one seating,
right,
by reverse engineering your menu, by managing constraints, by moving around, an extra one or two person in the kitchen who goes wherever the pressure is and relieves it, managing your labor like that, you could have twice the income, right? You could double your income every single night if you could do two evenings instead of one. Your labor would go up only pennies, maybe $100.
Mm-hmm.
You're maybe $100, $200 more labor to do another $10,000 of sales, and the only cost you have is the cost of product.
Wow.
Because everything else is fixed. Now that's the way to manage prime cost. By theory of constraints, by managing throughput, not by cutting hours. It's an absolute wrong thinking to say that I can cut the labor when it's already short-staffed in America anyway. Cut more, and all you're doing is, generally speaking, you're cannibalizing the engine of your race vehicle. Instead, you need to think about how do I need to teach my people to understand the business they're actually in, not the mythologies they've been led to believe throughout the generations.
That's so true. Amazing. For people listening, I'm telling you right now, you're going to have to rewind this and listen to it. There's some great stuff in here. Wow.
Well, think about this. One last thing. Okay. We now know for certain that nobody really learns, or very few people can learn anything by listening.
That's true.
You have to teach it to somebody else before your brain will say, this is important enough that I need to make it, burn it into the memory permanently.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's amazing how we still, right, every single day we give wine classes, we give service classes, we give menu description, we give all these things to our team, talking at them, and then we don't require them to learn it by teaching it to each other.
Exactly.
It's all for nothing. The last thing I think of is this, the thing that horrifies me the most. When I ask restaurateurs, what is the primary purpose of your business? I get two answers 99% of the time, and it depends whether they are above the halfway point in pricing or below the midpoint in pricing.
Right.
Below the midpoint, we sell food and beverage, to which I usually say, I sure hope to hell that that's not what you believe, because if you do, you're ruining the lives of your employees and you're hurting your customers.
Mm-hmm.
Above the waist, I usually hear, well, we're here to provide an experience. I sure hope to hell you don't believe that, because if you do, you're probably ruining the lives of your employees and really hurting your customers.
Mm-hmm.
How many times, Don, have you been at a restaurant? And every time you're at a restaurant, you have an important deal that's going down, even if you're alone. But you're with your wife. You're with a business. My definition of what is a restaurant comes out of its origin.
Yes.
Restaurants were imitations from the mercantile class first of the original stately homes. You know, hundreds of years ago, we didn't have municipal buildings in every town, hamlet, village, but you did have the stately home, the baron or the duke. And these were over centuries, they'd refined how to make them ever more powerfully productive for the business of state. Treaties were signed in stately homes, military plans, trade agreements, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And this is how they developed the brigade system in the kitchen, hierarchical as well as an hierarchical front of the house.
Right.
The butlers, the major domos, the footmen, the valets, and so forth. So when the aristocratic ultra elite started to soften, and restaurants came into being in France after the French Revolution, mm-hmm. The mercantile class created, they had this burgeoning need for a platform upon which to conduct the business of life, the business of business, excuse me. Okay, and then over time, as things became ever more democratized, you know, what I teach is that the function of a restaurant is to become the perfect platform upon which to conduct the business of life, whether that's business or whether it's personal. But what ends up happening is we tell people we're here to provide an experience. Ask yourself, with what? What tools and resources does a captain or a waiter have with which to create this experience? He has the steps of service and some relatively unimportant information.
Mm-hmm.
But you're telling him it's up to him to make it an experience. And so that develops this insane primacy of the steps of service and the information. Every restaurant you go to, I guarantee you'll answer this for me. I'm at a very expensive restaurant or a very inexpensive restaurant or anything in the middle, but I have an important business deal. I'm sitting around with 8 people or myself. And as a good host, you go in succession around the table. The first person tells a little anecdote, the second one a joke, the third a quip, a news, and you come around and now finally it's your turn. And you set up the joke. And the instant, like with laser preen precision, the instant you take that half inhalation with which to deliver the punchline, you know exactly what the fuck happens. In barrels, the oblivious, well, actually the directed missile of a waiter or waitress with this most important news, the so-called specials.
Oh.
You know, like here's a man who's been hypothetical. Think of the case, a man who's falsely been excused by his wife of an affair. It does happen. And, you know, some text messages from Alice, but Alice is his 96-year-old person who works in reception, so whatever. Anyway, for days on end, he's on his knees, he's begging, he's you know, trying to, you know, to get her finally to just give him a fair listening, and finally she agrees to go to dinner with him. And during that, he's just setting it all up, and of course, again, with laser precision, the instant that opening appears, the instant she's just finally ready to truly listen, in barrels the waiters with all this, it's as if they have been trained to be cock blocks.
It's true. It's so true.
I call the water pitcher a weapon of mass destruction.
Oh my
Who
God.
The fuck needs their water glass refilled every 30 seconds? Did we just crawl across the Gobi Desert before, you know, sitting in a chair? You see, I think we've forgotten in this country that the most important part, the most important skill in being a waiter is waiting. By that, I mean, wait until you're not causing harm to the deal that's going down.
Right.
And there is a deal going down on every table. Instead of being a cock block, try to be a wingman. See what you can do. Anything that is ethical and of highest integrity that allows the two people, the two parties on a table to be able to hear each other in good faith.
Mm-hmm.
That, after all, is the purpose of a restaurant. There is a deal going down on every table.
How can you make that deal happen?
Instead, it seems that most restaurants have untrained their staff of everything their good mothers had taught them. Johnny, don't you ever interrupt two adults when they're talking.
Right.
Unless it's an emergency. And if it's an emergency, make sure you ask permission. Please, may I interrupt you?
Mm-hmm.
Nothing you have to say as a waiter is that important that it deserves, that it warrants rudely interrupting someone who's in the middle of a conversation. Stand at the table. It generally only takes 1 or 2 seconds to be acknowledged your presence is there and mm-hmm. people are delighted to invite you in when the important thing they're talking about at the right moment.
Right.
That extra split second.
Okay. Yeah, you got to be able to read the table and read the energy.
That's right.
And contribute.
That's right.
To what their agenda is, not what your agenda is.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the truth. So true.
It's the reason so many restaurants are stripping away the front of the house staff. It's not because people are bad. The human beings they hire are wonderful. It's they're being mistrained
right.
to be destructive to the customer experience.
Right.
Rather, and so then they say, well, we just need you. Let's just replace it with automation. The answer wasn't automation. The answer was pulling your head out of your ass and actually thinking it through, questioning the first assumptions, and not just going with this dogma, this orthodoxy that we're here to create an experience. What the hell is that?
Yeah. We have to challenge our own realities. We have to ask better questions.
That's right.
That's what's going to save our industry.
That's right.
Yeah. Wow. You know, there's so much great stuff in here. And again,
we're just hitting the tip of the iceberg.
We are hitting the tip of the iceberg. And I think we're going to have another conversation about this in the future. So, you know, I want to say thank you so much, Greg, you know, for taking time. And one of the last questions I want to ask is, could you name like one guest that you recommend or one person you recommend to be a guest on the show?
Well, probably my dearest friend in the industry is Eric Repair. You know, he was actually my sous chef at Boulay.
No way.
Yeah, yeah. He and Kurt Gutenbrunner, you know, Valse. So we had one hell of a dream team then. So if, as far as a chef in America, it'd be one of mm-hmm. the most beautiful human beings, kind, loving, disciplined, you know, everything good that you can think of in a human being. Mm-hmm. He turned a difficult childhood around. You know, that's a great guest. You know, there are certain people that I would, you know, that have helped me immensely in understanding this world a little better and being able to predict economic trends more accurately.
Awesome.
With your better advice. I, you know, YouTube people like Richard Werner, the great economist, who's I think the world's top authority on investment on you know, investment banking and regulations and why it's not working. Why is it done that not a single orthodox economist predicted the great credit crisis or the savings mm-hmm. bomb before it? Why do we have 100% failure rate of prediction in our mainstream economics? Why is it that only 8 economists in the entire world predicted it? They called it almost perfectly on accurately, and they were all heterodox economists.
Yes.
Why is it we can't learn, you know, that famous quip, the one thing we learn from studying history is that we learn nothing from studying history, right?
Exactly. Economists and weather people are the only ones I know that they can be like wrong all the time and still have jobs, you know?
I'll tell you a funny story if you wish. So, you know, he was riling in 1991. And you know, these computers were coming out, and I think it was 91, 92, and Microsoft had this thing called Access. Oh my God, it's a database program. I said, this is miraculous. We're going to be able to keep track of our customers, you know, who's moving up, who's moving down, our top deciles, defection rates, itch cycles. And I said, you know, it's got to be easy. I'll read a book and I'll write a program. Well, needless to say, it's a steep learning curve, and the best I could do was come up with this bullshit little architecture, you know, and all we could study was basically total sales, not items. It's just too much. However, nonetheless, a few months later, I told the team, just let me know if there's any big changes. Okay. And a few months later, they come rushing me, Craig, chef, you got to come look at this. And so I did, and it's our number one client, Merck. the pharmaceutical company was a mile down the road, their international headquarters, and at the time they were considered the greatest company in the world, the number one highest ranked company. And so all of a sudden their sales were tripled overnight and staying steady at that. Okay. And I'm like, that's bizarre. And I said to myself, thinking quickly, I said, they have to have something going on over it. Maybe there's a merger. Maybe there's some new miracle drug. Mm. And I let it go. 4 or 5 days later, there's the chairman of the board, the president of Merck, in the cigar. And I go over and I said, oh, Mr. X, you know, I said, I want to say congratulations. And he says, what are you talking about, Craig? I said, well, you know, I just installed these computers. And I'm very proud of it. And we're watching everybody's spending patterns. Couldn't help but notice yours has suddenly tripled overnight. And I assume there's something going on. I said, Craig, sit your ass down. I said, yes, sir. He says, listen, I didn't get to be the number one CEO of the number one company in the world by guesswork. I measure shit too, he said. I said, oh, we just concluded a 2-year study of our business entertainment investments. I said, what? Yes, every single restaurant and hotel in the world where we spend money on business entertaining, we look at the return on investment of that. Oh, he said, yes. And you're about to hear the outcome. We don't know how you do it, Craig, but at the Ryland Inn, we close our deals far more often. Number two, we close our deals far more quickly. And most importantly, Craig, we close our deals far more profitably. I said, wow, I had no idea. I said, can I have a commission? Sit the fuck down. I said to him, gee, I never thought about it that a business would think of a restaurant meal as an investment, as that something they're going to get a return on. I thought they only thought about it as a line item expense. He says, well, Craig, we are different. I said, would you mind writing me a testimonial letter to that effect? And he said, I'd love to. And he did. And we sent that out over the next 6 months to something like 250 of the businesses in our target area, in our area. And our corporate business grew by almost 600% in a 12-month period.
Wow.
Again, this is exposure outside of the industry to a different way of thinking that produced an amazing return.
Yeah. And it also goes back to that thing about rethinking your model and the way that you process information in the sense of moving the guest's agenda forward.
Certainly.
You know?
Precisely. Move the guest's agenda.
Move the guest. Yeah, not yours.
Deal is the most important thing. Can you imagine if my team had been trained to interrupt the guest and the hosts of Merck when they have a $500 million, a $5 billion, a $50 billion deal going down,
right,
and we kiboshed the deal or slowed it down or made it less profitable? You know, how does the value of those dinner specials compare to losing $5 billion?
Right. Yeah, they're up with the dinner specials. Or, you know, my favorite one is like they're just about to have, you know, an important thing, and then the waiter walks up, you know, how's everything?
That's right. That's right. You know what? If I can save my marriage, if I can make a business deal happen, everything's going great.
Right.
But if you step in the way of that, everything is going wrong, you know? And clients won't talk about it. I think I remember seeing a business, a scientific survey. I thought it was something like 30 years ago, 35 years ago, each sector of the restaurant industry. And the question was for each sector of the meals you had last year in this sector of the restaurant industry, what percentage of them at least met your expectation? Do you care to guess what the answer was, Don?
It was pretty low.
It was 1%.
Oh, that's worse. I was going to say 3.
Which is actually good news. It means we're great teachers. It's just that we're teaching exactly the wrong things.
We are teaching the wrong things. Exactly. Outdated thinking patterns. Outdating models,
yep.
You know, mental models are huge, I think. And we need to challenge our thinking. It's the biggest thing.
Yep. Well, there's lots more to get into, but for another time.
I, yeah.
can't thank you enough for having me on. I'm very honored.
Oh, I'm honored. I am so honored. Thank you so much. And there will, I will add links to the show notes for anyone interested in contacting Craig about consulting or learning more about, you know, his Eon Consulting. I have a link to his books that he mentioned from his website. And in closing, I want to say this, you know, restaurants get better when the people in them become better people. And to do that, we need to challenge outdated thinking patterns, outdated business models, and we need to start looking at things from a different end. And Craig mentioned this, you know, reverse engineer, you know, what is our outcome? Why do we exist? And what is, you know, what is our goal? And if we're not getting the results we want, it's because we need to challenge the thinking patterns and the business models that we have. You know, are we a retail? Are we a manufacturing? What do we exist for? And what is our outcome and our goal? And if you start doing those things, you're going to shift your business to a totally different way of thinking. And when you do that, I think you're going to see some fantastic, fantastic results. And with that, we're going to basically sign off.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Restaurant Coach Podcast with Donald Burns. Tune in next time as we serve up more ways to maximize your potential. Visit our website at www.therestaurantcoach.com or download episodes at iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Spotify.